that an applicant planet defeats at least one species of proven sentience and achieves some rank other than miserably dead last, so to speak, they should be welcomed with open arms, spores, antennae, tentacles, wings, or other preferred appendages into the untidy lounge room of the extended galactic family. 14. In the event that a sentient species finishes in last place, they shall all go home and have a hard think about where they've gone wrong in life and promise never to do it again. 15. The final scoreboard shall determine the proportional distribution of all communally held galactic resources for the next cycle. See attached documents for a full explication of said resources. As this is kind of a big deal and has been, historically, the source of every war other than this one, see Rules 10, 17, and 18. 16. The undersigned, all their descendants, and any subsequently discovered civilizations we decide we can stand to talk to at parties, unto the heat death of the universe, or the next bout of belligerent stupidity makes all this maximally moot, whichever comes first, solemnly swear to play fair, listen with open minds, vote their feelings, not their ambitions, and not stack the roster with too many rookies all at once, so that everybody gets a really solid chance at not being vaporized if they don't deserve to be. 17. Any violators of Rule 16 shall be subject to the gentle ministrations of Rule 12. 18. The winner shall compel their government to pick up everyone else's drink tab, as well as put us all up and pay for the catering when we do this whole thing over again next year. No take-backsies, no changing mobile numbers, no pleading planetary austerity. Take out a loan from the Intergalactic Happy Friendship Bank like everyone else, you skinflint. 19. Try your best and have fun. After the corking incident at the 30th Grand Prix on the Uteric homeworld of Atorj, the subsequent trial, surprise exoneration, and politico-musical ascendancy of the perpetrators, Igneous Lagom Opt, Orcafall Avatar Zero, and the entity known as Monad, a 20th rule was added. At the time, the change was so controversial that protesters threatened to blow the 31st Grand Prix out of the sky if the Octave adopted it. However, with the launch of the Keshet Holistic Live Total Timeline broadcast, the effects of Rule 20 proved so unreasonably, voyeuristically, nail-bitingly fun to watch from home that the protesters got completely addicted to viewing parties, and it became the galaxy's favorite guilty pleasure and fundamentally changed the way the game was played, spectated, and won. 20. If a performer fails to show up on the night, they shall be automatically disqualified, ranked last, and their share of communal galactic resources forfeited for the year. Do try not to actually kill anyone. It's a dreadful bother to clean up the mess. 7. Miracles are happening from time to time. The watery drop of light that had been busy swelling at the tip of the Esker's proboscis reached critical mass. It plopped onto the filthy floor of Decibel Jones's flat. It splashed as it hit the carpet, and the splashing light formed itself into an image, a projection, alive with intention. As he watched, an army of musical notes and scales and flats and sharps danced and whirled over a phototopographical neon watercolor of the Bataclic sonic swamps and the occasional mountains of Kadj that were valleys in winter and Himalaya-crushing peaks at the height of summer. Decibel Jones knew those notes. He'd know them anywhere. They were Raggedy Dandy, which was, just maybe, the only really good song he'd ever written. The conversation between Decibel Jones and the Roadrunner bore almost no resemblance to the global template. It was mostly sung, rather than spoken word, for one thing, and involved an extended dance sequence and a bit with a cat. Is that really it? Des interrupted halfway through. We just sing better than one other beastie, and we get to live.
Yes. Does it seem barbaric to you? 67% of your population used that word.
No. It makes sense to me. It's perfect.
Why?
Decibel shrugged. Life is stupid and beautiful that way.
The Esker smiled. For the Esker can and do smile. All its feathers flushed an excited shade of cobalt.
He had said something good then.
Somehow, the world's luckiest fuck-up had done something right for once.
Though God and all his angels knew what.
He'd only said what he meant.
Which was, when you thought about it, a minor superpower, because so few people ever did. The blue creature danced coquettishly toward him, on those impossible, dumb legs that couldn't hold up a plastic garden flamingo, let alone this living, breathing version.
300 light-years from here, there is a small world called Bataclic, flying through the black. As blue as this world, and as dear. It is my world. It is where the antique Esker first opened their eyes and looked up into a sky filled with the mutation-nurturing warmth of a single white star, burning as if for us alone, looked out beyond the bracelet of our 20 mountainous moons into the all-possible cosmos, and first pondered whether to save some seeds and berries against the possibility of a lean and hungry winter, rather than devour them all at once. Do you know what your people call that sun that gives my people life?
No, said Jones.
You call it Mira Wonderful Star.
I knew somebody called that once.
I am aware, Mr. Jones.
Sure you're not after her? I'll warn you, she's tough to get a hold of these days.
Decibel stared out his grimy window.
She could have done your job, no problem. Save the world with a song? Just give her a minute to tune up. I'm just Mr. Elmer of the Fudd. Not even that.
The roadrunner crossed the little garret room, leaving wet, mandala-mouldering footprints on the scuffed carpet. It bent its enormous head and brushed the tip of its lantern against Dess's forehead. It felt like a kiss.
It felt like every kiss anyone had ever laid on anyone else. The good, the bad, the all-time great, the let's just be friends. All those kisses, all those mouths, all those feelings, electrified and painted blue.
Des didn't know why he did it, or even, honestly, how.
It had been years since this sort of thing had been a prominent water feature in the courtyard of his life. It had been years since it was how he made friends, and self-medicated, and got inspired, and entertained himself, and borrowed a cup of confidence from friendly neighbors.
It had been years since he'd felt himself enough to try. He put a hand on the Roadrunner's thin, jeweled, holy ribcage, and the hand was welcomed there.
I'm not sure I know this song, he whispered. How does it go?
By the time the rest of the world was finishing its exposition, an exhausted Decibel Jones had agreed to it all. To go to the stars and sing for his species, to follow that wascally wabbit, confess his sins, called out for breakfast, and become, entirely unbeknownst to him, resoundingly and inexplicably, though not by any human definition, pregnant. Point to Danny.
Water. The house is full of children. The relatives have come. I am going to put on my green dress. Party for everybody. Burannovskie babushki. 8. White and black blues.
Decibel Jones was already well on his way, but not to the Metagalactic Grand Prix. To Whitehall.
The instant the hungriest unpaid intern shadowing the lowest-ranking secretary to the most unremarkable member of parliament saw that the only living name on the alien's pop chart was a British subject, a nondescript black car carrying two nondescript men in black suits and black sunglasses spontaneously materialized out of a zebra crossing halfway to Croydon. Unfortunately, that trod-upon intern was merely quick, not alone. Thus, just as Dess and the Roadrunner were arguing the merits of Richard Harris's version of MacArthur Park vis-à-vis Donna Summers, a veritable unkindness of nondescript black cars descended furiously onto the pavement outside. A flock of fists pummeled the door and rang the buzzer. A gaggle of angry men's voices squawked out. Dinesh Yarlow! Dinesh Yarlow, this is insert steely-eyed organization here. It is imperative that we speak with you immediately. A murder of identically loafered feet kicked the door down and marched up the rickety staircase, and by the time Decibel Jones thought to wonder where the Esker had gone all of a sudden, he was crowd-surfing back down the walk-up staircase on a chattering brood of government shoulders. But the flight of the G-men broke apart when they hit their wall of parked cars. One after the other, square-jawed men, born with surnames like Brown, Davies, Evans, Taylor, and Price, and given names like Mr., Officer, Agent, Lieutenant, and Specialist, pecked and flapped at him. They took turns grabbing Decibel's McQueen-sheathed elbow with extravagantly aggressive masculinity and attempting to assert their dominance using only biceps, baritones, and a genetic inability to remove their sunglasses. "Watch the Swarovskis, boys," Des protested. "Damage this little number and I'll drop a whole fucking tax bracket."
"Mr. Yarlow, I'm with MI5, and you'll need to come with me at once."
"MI6, Mr. Yarlow, and this is my jurisdiction, Evans, so fuck off. Overseas intelligence. Very, very overseas, I should say."
"The intelligence may be foreign, but Dinesh here is quite domestic, Taylor, which is MI5's territory, so it's you who'll be fucking off, I'm afraid. Better luck next invasion." "Now, Danny, my lad, don't let these two confuse you. Metropolitan Police Anti-Terrorism Squad at your service. Get in the car. There's a good fellow."
"Stand down, Davies. You're relieved. You can all stand down. Downing Street calling, Mr. Yarlow. The Prime Minister wants you."
"Well, I can't say I haven't given it the occasional thought. The PM's a bit of all right,"
Dess managed to quip. If he lost everything else, pride, priapism, and producer credit, Decibel Jones would never, never give up his swagger.
"That's enough of that, sir. Now, I'm to bring you to Cobra to meet with the emergency committee, of which the Prime Minister is chair, so there must be some manner of mix-up, but it'll all sort out at Whitehall."
"Son, I'm your liaison to the United Nations. It's imperative that I take you into protective custody. This clearly isn't a UK op, you asshats. Go have a cup of tea, or whatever it is you all do while the big boys are talking."
"The Foreign and Commonwealth Office kindly invites you to eat a shit, Yank. He's ours and you know it. We'll let you know if anybody descends from the heavens asking for Taylor Swift, won't we, lads?"
The cause of the authoritarian brood started coming thicker and faster, until Decibel felt vomit rising again. He knew better than to struggle when in the grip of bureaucracy. But he couldn't breathe. The smell of dry-cleaned blazers and recently signed in triplicate forms was overpowering. Where was a bloody damned giant space flamingo when you needed one?
"S.A.S., Yarlow. On your feet. Look lively. Fall in."
"Home Office, Dinesh. Come along now."
"U.K.S.A., sir. You'll want to follow me."
"G.C.H.Q., Mr. J. On you get."
"O.A.A., Dan. Let's get a move on, shall we?"
"Wait, what the hell's an OAA?
Yelled the Prime Minister's secretary from the back of the rookery. Office of Alien Affairs. We're new.
The OAA agent checked his watch. In 2.5 minutes, it'll be the 90-minute anniversary of our founding. Daily Mail, Des. Let's get you away from these jolly jackboots and down to the newsroom on the double quick. The people have a right to know what kind of person is going to represent them. Now, be honest, mate. Don't you think the first UK ambassador to another world ought to be a bit more, I don't know, English?
Decibel yanked his over-misted arm out of the reporter's skinny talons.
Oh, go eat an entire bucket of cot.
Beg pardon, Mr. Jones. I'm a great fan of your work, by the way. Really. I've set my employer's ringtone to terms of service for years. I've been charged by the Queen to convey you directly to Her Majesty's audience room. I believe you'll find that head of state trumps these earnest chaps any way you look at it. Right this way, sir.
Decibel Jones sighed and shook his head. Today was fired. Today was well and truly sacked. Today could, in point of fact, fuck all the way off.
Well, Terms of Service is just about the only song on that album I didn't write. So what a fantastic job you've done with your sucking up. Full marks.
There were too many of them. Decibel pinballed through the parliament of men in black, from manful grip to manful grip, until he just toppled into a car, the way he used to when his manager had to beat off a gauntlet of handsy fans to get him to his next gig. They were screeching down a side road in reverse before he even figured out what car had got him in the end. The glitterpunk glamrock messiah peered across the shadowy expanse of the official vehicle of Decibel Jones's grand tour of government agencies. It was a kind of munted limousine, with a cavernous rear arranged so that the two passenger benches faced each other. Four oversized, oddly insectoid sunglass lenses reflected the sunlight flitting through tinted windows.
"Afternoon, gents,"
Des said, and hoped to Christ his voice wasn't actually shaking as much as it felt like it was. Silence. Cool, unfeeling, taxpayer-funded silence.
"That arse from the Daily Mail had a point, Mr. Price,"
one of the mystery men said finally.
"Indeed he did, Mr. Brown,"
the other said with a nod.
"It's quite a little bit of egg on the face of the Commonwealth. Of the three of them, he's the only one actually born here. And he's what, Pakistani-Nigerian on his dad's side and Welsh-Swedish on the matrilineal? How does that even get past the first date? The girl was some sort of Japanese-Franco-Jewish muddle from Dublin by way of sodding Warsaw. But I gather she's out of the picture. And the other chap is a God and all the angels save us refugee Turk. Of course, it's unclear whether they actually want his backing band. But I can't imagine they cross the void of space on the strength of his solo album. Why our new friends couldn't have opted for a nice English band instead of this pottage of regrettably issued work visas, I'll never know."
"We are English, you tit,"
Decibel said with a sigh, glancing at his fingernails, which were much in need of a filing. He was used to this sort of thing. He was used to this sort of thing by the time he was 12. He'd always had the kind of face that made people squint and try to think of a polite way to say, "Just what exactly are you, kid?" As though he might legitimately answer, "Rhinoceros," or "Sea cow," or "Aldebaran." And that bit of genetic luck had saved him more than once. If they couldn't tell, they couldn't bring themselves to do anything about it. Usually.
"So was my nan, if you want to have a squabble about it. Not that that stopped you lot. Some might say we're a pretty nice spread of humanity between the three of us.
Two. Now.
But still covering a lot of territory. Rather ideal, if you ask me."
His escorts continued to ignore him. He was used to that, too. 10 million teenagers once screaming your name never meant one piddly thing to the authorities when you dressed like he did.
"It's certainly not a good look on us,"
Is he gay as well? Good lord.
I'm sitting right here,
Decibel sighed. Mr. Brown flipped through a folder on the seat next to him and continued on as though Decibel Jones were no more than a cup holder.
It's a bit unclear, but that's the youth for you these days. There's been the odd paternity suit, but none paid out. The three of them, always a bit suspect, if you ask me. All musicians are. Jones did say he was an equal opportunity bisexual in an interview right after Space Crumpet hit. But his female fans got their feathers ruffled, or rather, their parents did, at which point he said he was omnisexual, whatever that means. And then he seems to have made up a lot of words that give me a right headache. What in blazes is a boy frack, other than an insult to the language?
Aught Saint Ultraviolet shook loose all my combustibles,
Des answered with the gentle smile of having lost something wonderful. He picked at a loose stitch in the leather of the door handle. And every time we touched, it was an endless earthquake in a faultless land. Mr. Price gave him a disgusted look, which was impressive, given that his eyes were still invisible behind dark glasses. Correctly deployed, a curled lip can communicate entire essays on the effects of moral turpitude.
At least Mr. Kalashkan is married to someone the name of Justine in Cardiff with two kids.
I don't see where you get off fretting about whether or not the end of the world is family-friendly. Do you really think the giant singing space aliens care? Every minute you spend sniffing around bedrooms past is a minute I'm not writing the song that saves the species, you know?
The words went all sour in Dess's mouth, and for the first time in his life, he started to feel the black adrenaline of stage fright coming on. It was an old arrogance, one that still fit him around the shoulders, but was far too tight in the middle. He hadn't written a new song in 4 or 5 years, at least, and it hadn't been a good one then. This was a joke, a very unfunny joke, and whether he was the setup or the punchline, he'd no idea. Humanity was doomed. At last, the men in black deigned to speak directly to him.
Obviously, we have a team of the best songwriters working round the clock to create a winning track for you, so don't worry about that.
Des stared resentfully out the window at the passing lampposts.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought they wanted us,
he grumbled.
Can't leave this sort of thing to people who thought Ultraponts would be a smash, can we? It'll also be outfitted with the latest in audio-visual recording equipment. The emergency committee will run down the most important data to acquire, particularly in terms of propulsion, ship design, weaponry, cultural intel in terms of what that might tell us about their tactical predilections once you arrive at Letost, which is, what, Price, 6,500-odd light-years away? In the Eagle Nebula, we think. Now, unfortunately, we don't actually have any way of transmitting information at that distance, so unless you can sort out how they do it, it'll all be recorded and retrieved when you return.
That is entirely unnecessary, said a new voice. Decibel Jones turned his head toward it, and his mind was genuinely delighted to see the Roadrunner, or at least its projection, suddenly sitting calmly next to him in the back of the car. His body, however, reverted instantly to the primeval instinct to escape predators by jumping out of a closed, shatterproof window into traffic. He bounced off it and back into his seat, trying, halfway through, to look cool doing it, and failing profoundly. The Esker's proboscis lantern was cramped by the low roof. It did not seem bothered. The alien spoke in the voice of Her Majesty Queen Charlotte I, having skimmed the mind of Mr. Brown and Mr. Price, and found there an abject longing to have lived at a time when being in service to a monarch granted a great deal more leeway in the pummeling of peasants department. The Grand Prix is the most watched event in the galaxy, more popular even than Live from Luno, It's an Exceedingly Censored Comedy Night, and The Yurtmak Present Super Murder Derby 9000. It will be broadcast throughout the galaxy from the moment the human hopefuls land on Letost. The agents glanced at each other, which was the only expression of shock and horror at the sudden appearance of an alien in their car that their training allowed.
"Ma'am,"
Mr. Brown began automatically, though the Queen was quite clearly not present.
"I really don't see why we don't get a say in all this. Mightn't we have an audition process of some sort, or at least present you with a more contemporary list of our own favourites? I quite like the new Parental Guidance album. Have you heard them? Real spit-and-shine boys. British boys. We could be proud to have those lads stand up for England. For the planet. Really, how are we meant to put gender splat on a personnel intake form?"
The Esker turned its oceanic gaze on Decibel Jones. "We presumed it meant he was like us. The Esker possess four genders, male, female, fugue, and clef. The male inseminates the eggs of the female. The fugue then ingests the eggs and provides nutrients over the period of gestation. And the clef prepares the birthing grotto by producing a genetic bath of virile fluid, song, and information-rich light generated by its kuma." The creature raised those large, gentle eyes to the lantern hanging from its head by a ribbon of glassy flesh. At which point, the infant offspring explode rather forcefully from the flute cage of the fugue and complete their development immersed in the aforementioned multisensory broth. It's all rather beautiful, even if the fugue does not generally survive. I myself am clef, and took gender splat to mean Mr. Jones was also. Is that not correct, Mr. Jones?"
"Close enough, darling," Des replied, shrugging, unable to beat back a deeply inappropriate bout of laughter.
"What's the pronoun on that?"
"You do not have the embouchure to pronounce it, more's the pity. You may use she for your convenience, as it contains both your limited binary terms. It is inaccurate, but English leaves us few options, as it implies an inanimate object, which we are not. Though you may be, that is, of course, the question at hand. Regardless, your input is neither needed, wanted, valued, nor at all welcome, gentlemen." The Queen's voice said out of the beak of a blue lantern bird. "You may not believe it, but we are helping you. You are terribly lucky. Another chaperone species might have actually let you audition your own performers. But the Esker are sensitive to the needs of lesser worlds, having only recently earned our place among the great ones. We have chosen, we have given you an advantage you may not deserve. Our ship awaits, impatiently."
"Wait!"
Decibel Jones said with a sudden, frantic horror.
"Parental guidance isn't so bad, really. At least they churn out albums every year. At least they're dependable. I'm..."
He looked pleadingly into the eyes of the weird blue future, and even he had no idea whether he was pleading to be excused or to be told he was everything the world had ever needed. His voice dropped to a whisper. "You have to know. I'm a has-been. If I'm even that. I barely was, really. I'm the coyote. I make the most magnificent contraptions, and I always think, this time everyone will see how good I really am. But they only ever burn me up and leave me starving to death."
The Roadrunner nodded kindly.
"Mr. Jones, would it help if I told you that somewhere out there, so far away that, if you left today, your great-great-grandchildren would die before they ever got to try the sandwiches at the first available fuel depot?
on a world of lava and oceans of acid orbiting a double star. There is a crystal balloon filled with intelligent gas named Ursula, who knows all the words to Raggedy Dandy? Decibel Jones's matinee eyes went soft and round. He grinned.
It does, actually.
I am gratified, said the Esker. Mr. Price and Mr. Brown were not finished.
This is rank madness, ma'am. Begging your pardon, you say we've got to sing better than some lizard person from Planet X or we'll be destroyed. Fine. You say we've got no choice. Fine. But we're all human beings. We all stand to get blown to bits if this boy doesn't pull it off.
I need my band, though, Decibel said softly. He put his hand on the Roadrunner's spindly knee. His fingers slipped through the projection and onto the black leather seat beneath. He stared at that for a bit, feeling strongly as though he'd had his fill of oddity for the moment, and knowing there was only more to come in the pudding.
What's left of it, anyway? It's no good without aught. And Robert. Fuck. I left Robert. Everything happens so fast. You've got to get him back for me, or the whole thing's off.
We would never book Decibel Jones without the Zeros. As I've said, we aren't monsters, the Roadrunner assured him. I am afraid, however, that forgetting your coat does not constitute an emergency. Every world has coats. You will survive.
We are representatives of Her Majesty's government and the office of the Prime Minister and Homo sapiens sapiens, goddammit,
spluttered the agents, half out of their seats, though the car was still hurtling along.
We should be allowed to choose our own representatives, our own warriors.
I am sorry, dear boys, but this is not a war. It is not about you, nor are you a part of it. Every child in the galaxy learns the truth about politics at their mother's proboscis. For lo, does not Gogonar's third unkillable fact tell us? Though any species on any dumb gobworld may develop sentience, the poor bastards, no government ever does. Think on it, Mr. Brown, Mr. Price. Only meters from the Whitehall car park, Decibel Jones and the Roadrunner dissolved into a very pretty swirl of magenta steam that smelled largely of fish and disdain. 9. Diamond of Night. The first metagalactic Grand Prix was held on the hot, vast, dark planet of Sagrada, homeworld of the Elecon, the oldest functioning civilization in the galaxy. They were ancient already when the first Lunazar had the grand idea of opposable nubs. They were yelling at gravity to get off their lawn when the Keshet were nothing but a twinkle in the space-time continuum's eye. In their smug middle age, they saw the fall of the great Empire of the Itridge, who started the whole trend of rings round planets, just so that they could remember where they parked. And in the face of their glory, the Elecon yawned. Sagrada was chosen for the Grand Prix because, despite the Elecon's mind-smearingly advanced military, they had stayed neutral in the sentience wars, as they did in all wars, if they could possibly manage it without looking like a bunch of Trustafarian art school seniors who weren't even going to bother with the group gallery show because, you know, the system, man. As Muzma the Night Manager, the greatest of all Elecon rulers, wrote in his autobiography, Who Moved My Invincible Doomsday Device, neutrality was always a much more delicate operation than war or peace. Neutrality without a respectable bulge of firepower in your pocket was as good as telling the universe, I am a helpless, vulnerable, fuzzy baby with a wet pink nose. Please annihilate me at your earliest convenience. But declaring neutrality from beneath an elaborate pillow fort of prosperity, military dominance, and a diverse entertainment industry
made you look as enticing to all your post-war neighbours as a rich kid's lunch money. After all, it's always the fancy house that keeps its lights off and won't shell out for candy that's first pillaged on Halloween. You might think that Mesmer the Night Manager could not possibly have known about the regional human holiday known as Halloween, but by one of those many curious coincidences that comprise the only real evidence for a divine and wobbling hand in the design of the universe, some variant of Halloween is celebrated by every sentient species in the galaxy. There is, it would appear, something about the achievement of sentience that immediately fills the afflicted with the longing to become something else, something brighter, something wilder and more fearsome and morbid and covered in felt and glue and glitter, to escape into the mask of some other impossible life, and to afterward consume vast quantities of sweets. This carefully balanced neutrality was the second most significant factor in the longevity of their society. The first was Sagrada itself. If you look up into the night sky, you will not see Sagrada. Not from Earth. Not from Bataclic. Not even from Gak-Gak, Sagrada's largest and most socially toxic moon. The planet reflects almost none of the already miserly light from its shriveled, demented red sun. Rather, it greedily absorbs every photon until its surface shimmers with heat. That surface is wholly, utterly, indescribably black, from pole to pole, peak to peak, sea to shadowed sea. It is far blacker than coal, or petroleum, or the heart of a high school poet. Far blacker than a mere total absence of light. It is surrounded by a mob of moons, made of the same swarthy stuff, which block out starlight like bouncers at the hottest club in town. Sagrada is a study in darkness, an adoringly monogamous commitment to the Gothic aesthetic. Besides Sagrada, ravens are as bright as parrots, widows are as flamboyant as cabaret dancers, and black holes suffer from crippling penumbra envy. For obvious reasons, in Elikish, the word black and all its synonyms occupy the same linguistic niche as words like cool, sweet, brilliant, highly skilled, and built like a brick shithouse. In order to function in all this dimly red-rimmed darkness, the body of an Elik is small, dense, nearly indestructible by anything that might be lying about, around, or in wait in the shadows, and mostly eyeballs. If a particularly melancholy child stacked a huge black ball of hard suet on top of a dainty black suet cone, gave it a lot of elegantly styled coaxial cable for hair, and stuck two enormous old-fashioned light bulbs on it where eyes should generally go, they'd have a pretty solid approximation of an Elik with which to horrify their parents. And yet, the Elikon are widely considered to be a beautiful people. Their eyes quickly evolved to occupy nearly all their facial real estate, the better to devour any available light like starving beggars. Their long, long lashes are powerful sensory organs, like cats' whiskers. If cats could sense predators, weather systems, and other annoyances miles away. The hard, slightly greasy suet of their flesh is remarkably malleable, able to imitate a wide variety of limbs and other convenient protrusions. Imagine Sagrada in its earliest pastoral days. The Elikon, in their black villages, peacefully tilling black fields of midnight barley in the shadows of Onyx Mountains, carrying their tiny charcoal children to dig black clams from a black beach near a black sea, looking up into a sky so dark that it depressed itself. When the first alien starship cruised through their atmosphere and dumped a cargo hold full of state secrets onto their planet, the Elikon were able to advance technologically at a rate far faster than any other species to date, because the rest of the galaxy used Sagrada as its personal high-end rubbish bin.
What better place to hide something you didn't want anyone else to find than a planet so dark it was practically invisible? The heavens rained down data crystals, prototype vessels, unwanted furniture, spent weapons, drugs, bodies, treaties, vast sums of intergalactic currency, more data crystals, and any commodities a governing body might want to remove from the market in order to create a sudden and profitable demand. Civilizations rose and fell and ran smack into walls, but the Elecon went on, collecting, analyzing, improving, remembering. In fact, in every language other than Elekish, the word for the massively useful Black World Sagrada translates to the memory bin, and to leave something there was to have it binned. After happily using everyone else's dirty little secrets to establish dominance over their sector, and a continuous, lively civilization whose general tranquility Masmar the Night Manager famously attributed to the fact that light is a well-known irritant to all thinking, feeling beings, the Elecon made the rather unexpected choice not to tell everyone to shove off and stop using their world as a collective toilet down which to flush any incriminating evidence the second the police came knocking. Instead, they became the great archivers and curators of galactic culture, hyper-attentive beatnik librarian salvagers, combing every black inch of Sagrada for debris to analyze, label, and include in climate-controlled exhibits in the long, hexagonal, black granite halls of the Melanoa Trementis Library, a palace of knowledge as large as Hungary, as well organized as a retirement home for executive assistants, and as well guarded as the meaning of life. The first Metagalactic Grand Prix was held in the Melanoa Trementis Library's Special Collections Room, as it contained the only stage with any real size or grandeur left standing after the war, and afterward, the whole thing could be immediately and efficiently binned, a word which had come, over the millennia, to mean carefully, lovingly recorded for posterity by the Elecon and preserved against the ravages of time, war, and the children's disrespect for history. The winner of the first Grand Prix was an Alunazar ultra-tenor girl group called Glagol Jusen and the Death of All That Came Before, singing what would become the first interstellar smash single, Maybe We'll Just Stay In Tonight Instead of Doing the Whole Intergalactic Civil War Thing, Wouldn't That Be Nice? 5 massive tubular sea squirts, protean tubes of golden and violet and scarlet-veined flesh, with a round, cilia-fringed siphon at each end that served as mouth, nose, face, cyclopean eye, and simple jet propulsion system, undulated with passion. Their siphons, gaping with grief and ecstasy, hovered in the air above the weeping crowd, suspended in an orb of moonlit water rescued at the last possible second from their ruined homeworld. Naturally, it wasn't just the 5 of them. The Alunazars are the greatest practitioners of attachment parenting in the known universe. When an Alunazar reproduces, their children do not go out into the world to make their fortune and curse the urban dating scene, but simply bud from their mother or father, emerging out of their backs or their bellies as a complete and individual and rebellious bulge, but never leaving home. Each Alunazar is a colony. A generation ship, accumulated centuries of wisdom and experience and quick tempers and belligerent dinner conversations in one extremely lumpy, extremely lovely tube of glowing aquatic flesh. The death of a single Alunazar is the death of an entire nation, and the wars had gone on for years. Glagol Jusen and the Death of All That Came Before sang in perfect, bone-shattering, 5,000-part harmony, with the combined voices of their entire genetic lines. And they wept, the rosy pink electricity generated by 5,000 weaponized agony ducts. And they performed the traditional Alunazar interdimensional two-step,
which no foreigner had ever been allowed to witness before that moment in the Black Library. A dance halfway between Bollywood and SeaWorld, lit only by the bioluminescent fires of their tears and the transported moonlight of poor, far-off, still smoldering, Aluno Prime. At the climax of the dance, there was a brilliant, iridescent spiderweb of exploding light, and Glagol Jacem phased into a dimension where the whole notion of sentience had never gotten past committee. Wriggled with delight, made a salacious gesture in the general direction she'd come from, and never came back. They won by a single point. 10. Don't go without me. On a plush paisley couch, in a large and tastefully furnished suburban home outside London, Omar Jalishkan, better known as Aught Saint Ultraviolet, the only one of the absolute zeros to make it through fame and fortune and their opposites without a personality disorder, ambiguously employed royalty collector, erstwhile boyfrack, about to be ex-husband to a deeply alienated woman in Cardiff, reasonably responsible father of two, and one-man band, slept off the last bender of his marriage, the massive take-out vindaloo he'd ordered in, and through the invasion of Earth, on a long, cool river of Ambien, absinthe, and regret. Omar Jalishkan, like all humans who found themselves asleep at noon on a Thursday, spoke to the roadrunner in his dreams. In the lounge room he shared with Justine and the kids, an ordinary lounge room belonging to an ordinary family, between the well-worn blue and copper-striped couch they'd bought before Nico was born, and the black, lacquered, vaguely Asian-styled end tables they'd picked up for practically nothing when Justine's hotel remodeled. The 7-foot-tall ultramarine fish flamingo looked far less alarming than it did in the real world, being only a dream. The girls played on his mother's red and gold rug, squabbling over a toy that looked very much like planet Earth. Their cat, Capo, fortunate refugee from a local shelter and the birthday present he'd never outdo, hissed at the clouds over Australia. The ghost of his father sat in the leather recliner, sipping a tropical drink from a glittery pink straw. And a giant bird was telling him he was going to have to save the world with his autophone. It was an ordinary dream for an ordinary man under severe emotional and dietary distress. Nothing you wouldn't expect when you knocked back the acknowledged world heavyweight champion of sleeping pills.
"Remember, Omarchik,"
his father's ghost said in the dream, peering at his son over the sugared rim of his drink, just as he'd said when they were finally given permission to move into their flat in Manchester when Omar was 6, just as he'd done every night that Omar had been sober enough to dream since.
"We are ordinary English family now. When the world turns the wrong way round, ordinary is the best defense. Nobody bothers an ordinary English bloke man. Nobody makes a file on him. Nobody asks him who his business is. Nobody tells him, 'Come with me and don't make a fuss.' If anybody bothers you, you just be so ordinary, Yvette."
Omar stuck hard to his father's rules. English bloke man became a kind of untouchable superhero in his head. A man so normal, nothing abnormal could ever touch him. And, for a long time, nothing did. Faster than a well-ordered queue, more powerful than a muttered tut, able to walk right by police officers without being harassed. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's the fragile illusion of invulnerability inherent in being just like everyone else. No, it's English bloke man. Even at the height of Absolute Zero's mania, Omar Jalishkan saw nothing remotely out of the ordinary about his life. Aught Saint Ultraviolet, for all his rhinestones and rouge, was simply the predictable outcome of practicing guitar more than multiplication tables,
more than talking to girls, more than looking old enough to buy his own pints, of loving music like it gave birth to him, of moving to London as soon as humanly possible, of doing time in the club scene and at open mics, and tolerating the personalities of people who could sing because they wanted to start a band, but not like he wanted a band. Of going home with random, artistically promising strangers, because you never knew which one was your future until you were ordering them ice cream at 5 in the morning. Omar drew a straight line from their sold-out world tour, back and back and back to the day he'd started school in Manchester, when the music teacher had set up every instrument you could play in the band or orchestra in a big circle on the thin, lowest bidder grey carpet of the classroom that had never been much better than concrete, and let all the goggling children go around and toot and twang and whistle and blow on every one of them until they found something they liked, or shoved their hands in their pockets and said they only wanted to play football, Mum, and so refused to do the one thing that meant anything in this world. Little Omar had approached them all with enormous, worshipful dark eyes. The violin, and the oboe, and the trumpet, and the guitar, and the drums, and the trombone, and the clarinet, and the cello, touching them as shyly as he would one day touch Mira, and Dinesh, and Justine, making them all talk with his fingers and his mouth and his breath, and whirled round to hug his parents desperately, whispering into their legs, "But I want to play them all, Mum. I want them all. Don't make me choose. I can't. I can't." Everything that had happened to him afterward was the perfectly normal extension of that day, of that child. Even the trash fire that was Ultra Ponce, even rehab, even Justine getting pregnant when they'd been so careful, even that horrible night in Edinburgh, even their second daughter, just as unexpected and unimaginable as the first. Even Justine's affair, and his, and then couples therapy on Tuesday nights for the rest of recorded time, and even working for 15 years as a session musician like it was an office job, playing anonymously on other people's albums, other people's genres and styles and standards, in jeans and a t-shirt, for someone else's band, and only enough concealer to conceal his hangover, just as long as he was still playing. That was all fine. That was all normal. If you were writing a book about a failed pop group, that's how it would go. It was an ordinary story. The story of 1,000 other musicians. The story of English Bloke Man. Omar felt safe inside that story. If not happy. If not much of anything else.
"Does it ever make you sad to only have one moon?"
the roadrunner said, grooming Justine's long brown hair with its dark beak, while she stared straight ahead into the nothing of dreams.
"It would make me sad."
"It's the usual number, isn't it?" Omar asked, quite worried.
"Not overly,"
answered the fish bird, and then Capo was pouncing hard on his snoring chest, and licking him, and kneading him, until Omar Jalishkan groaned himself awake. He opened his gunked-up eyes to find himself meeting the cool, mouthwash, green, feline gaze of the short-haired white cat that had stayed when his wife had not. Capo seemed to have brought company. Something was looming behind her. Two somethings. Two blurry somethings. Something neither cats, nor daughters, nor estranged wives, nor curry delivery men. Something old, and something blue. Omar's vision finally focused around the Roadrunner and Decibel Jones. He had no idea what was going on, but it felt somehow inevitable. He had always been headed for something this unrelentingly, unforgivingly stupid.
"Hiya, Ort,"
Decibel said as gently as he could under the circumstances. The Esker cleared her long, soft throat, and asked in an eminently neighborly tone,
"Do you think I might trouble you for a steak and a glass of milk? Whole, if you have it, but 2% would be fine."
11. 1944. The sentience wars began and ended
at a public bus stop. Starships are frightfully useful and pleasant things, but not, strictly speaking, a must-have to get around town. Even the jankiest hand-me-down FTL-capable hoopty that couldn't pass a special relativity inspection to save its intrepid bridge crew is the neon track-lit, fully stocked wet bar, stripper-pole-fitted super-bass party limousine of galactic travel. It doesn't just get you from planet to planet. It gets you there in comfort, good company, high style, full of canapes with a good buzz going and looking like somebody to reckon with, which is very important to most young species trying to splash some cash around and make their mark on the nightlife. But you could always take the bus. In the early days of the universe, whether or not a habitable planet happened to have a wormhole nearby was as consequential to the eventual political map as whether or not a particular group of humans happened to be born on a continent with domesticable animals on tap, or an island the size of a doorknob where the only source of reliable protein was a semi-poisonous tuber. Wormhole, or no wormhole, had just as little to do with the inherent superiority and or possibly divine mandate of the smirking bastards who won the cosmic draw as cow or no cow. And yet, everyone everywhere will do, say, and stab nearly anything if it means they get to believe that they are blessed and their neighbors are basically toad people. Listen, the galaxy is a pretty damnable woolly place, and we've got a lot to cover in a short time if we're going to get through the whole war. But try not to forget about the cows. They're going to be important in a minute. For the fortunate sons, the Uterek, the Keshet, the Vorpret, the Ilunazar, the invention of space travel was as easy as building a big empty box and chucking it out of your gravitational well like a lucky shot skee ball, straight into the 100-point hole waiting on the left-hand side of history. Everyone else had to grope around in the dark, strapped to atomic bombs, until they ran face-first into something other than more dark. It took the poor Inaki so long to invent FTL spaceflight that they actually skipped right over it and straight to medium-range instantaneous matter transportation, which is, in retrospect, much more practical for a species of parasitic fireflies so impossibly tiny that you can't believe they have enough room for an internal monologue, all clinging to the bodies of gentle-eyed, extremely itchy pachyderms on one perpetually cloudy rock in the constellation of Draco. It wasn't fair. It wasn't equal. There wasn't anything to be done about it, since you could no more move an active wormhole than you could move a politician to pity. The distribution of wormholes and livestock with potential was an invisible lottery ticket purchased long before the first primordial molecules got into the oozing business, which could only be won or lost, never exchanged, ignored, or tried again, and it determined the courses of lives beyond counting. Now these days, wormholes are galactic public transport. Taken for granted, run down, underfunded, unsanitary, and unloved, crammed with commuters and pensioners, unruly young species, and drunks who can't get home on their own power. The walls of any given wormhole are infested with indecipherable graffiti in ancient, impossible tongues, the only evidence of entire cauterized timelines and vast, unspeakable intelligences trapped on the other side of the cohesion matrix, as well as whether or not Ursula was here. You are almost certain to get gum, or vomit, or causality, or all three, on your shoes. For a few centuries there, the Ilunazar got away with claiming to have invented wormholes. This allowed them to collect spectacular tolls, tax cargo, conduct random security checks, and confiscate any particularly exciting items, and shut down routes for regularly scheduled repairs that, by innocent coincidence, happened to be popular with civilizations who objected to the Empire's habitual interstellar man-spreading. Their story passed the smell test, at least.
Those blobby, overgrown, stained glass sea squirts had been around longer than anyone except the Elecon, whose entire society depended on never spilling anyone else's socio-political beans, no matter how piping hot and juicy. They did seem to know how to patch up the works when the system sprung a reality leak. And Illuno Prime was undeniably parked in just about the most advantageous spot in the whole quadrant, cozily adjacent to the N, F, R, L, and J lines. Besides, how else could they have colonized so much so fast? Aquatic species have a notoriously tough time handling the usual technological transition from ruining their own planets to ruining whole solar systems. While mammals, insects, and enlightened lichen can zip about as long as they take along a few houseplants to micromanage the air cycle. The unlucky space whales of this universe have to sort out how to get a ship overburdened with the absurd weight of a personal ocean into high orbit. No matter the magnitude of science's triumph over nature, it will always be much easier to get a helium balloon to fly than a water balloon. Yet, everywhere you went, the Illunazar were already there. They lied, of course. Oh, how they lied. They lied through their siphons. They lied shamelessly, for generations, without a single ill-timed giggle, to give up the game, until the truth took out 3 Keshet frigates, 6 moons, a pulsar, and a Lunazar mining colony as close to the border of Yuz space as they could manage, and still get invited to holiday parties. A Yuz yacht containing the royal family on its way to their annual beach holiday. A bathtub containing Muzmar the Night Manager, ancient ruler of the Elecon, who was very surprised indeed to find himself naked and soapy and cold on the black floor of his ablution chamber. 2 of the Pleiades, a generous complimentary fruit basket provided to the Sex Pistols by Portobello Hotel in 1978, and the Inaki homeworld. None of that makes the least bit of sense, naturally, because you've already forgotten the cows. Up until that moment, the galactic scientific consensus wasn't too far off the human scientific consensus on the subject of wormholes, except that we thought they were purely theoretical, and everyone else got really irritated if they were closed for maintenance. A wormhole was a tear in the universe, where space and time went to get well and truly hammered. They passed through every physical and temporal point simultaneously, and dumped you out wherever the other end of the tunnel is, no worse for wear, with only the teensiest bit of cancer. As long as you kept your arms and legs inside the vehicle, there's almost no danger of permeating the membrane of reality. In the drawing rooms of spacefaring society, the insectoids assured the silicon-based that the prehistoric Lunazar had probably done it with plain old explosives, and almost certainly didn't know any more than anyone else, except how to time a fuse. They were wrong. Despite their big lie, the Lunazar actually did know far more about wormholes than they were willing to share in mixed company. They had lived alongside them for the entire history of their soft and tubular race. They had used them to acquire an interstellar empire at a fabulously steep discount. They had tended and groomed and guarded the cosmic subway for thousands of years. They hadn't the first thing to do with inventing wormholes. It was the same pure, imbecilic, drooling luck that so many of the bloody things opened up just outside Illuno Prime's gravitational sphere of influence that dealt Europe a royal flush of luxury, high-speed horses, butter-dispensing cows, jumper-shedding sheep, bacon-distributing pigs and non-unionized donkeys, and Australia a full hand of fuck-all. You can't, after all, invent an animal. You can only domesticate it. It's all down to cows in the end, you see. Cows and what wonders can be done with them. The fact of the matter is, a great number of people have, for some time now, been merrily lobbing themselves both ways through the digestive tract of incomprehensibly ancient, infinitely unbothered beasts, and paying handsomely for the privilege. Life is beautiful, and life is stupid. The life cycle of a quantum-tufted domesticated wormhole, Lacuna vermis familiaris, takes place on a scale that beggars the imagination, kicks it while it's down, and lights it on fire. Admittedly, striking anatomical differences aside, of all the species in the known universe, they have the most in common culturally with the giant panda bear of Earth. They are large, slow, solitary creatures,